and welcome to Marketing Smarts, a podcast brought to you by Marketing Profs. I am your host, Matthew Grant, Managing Editor here at Marketing Profs, and I thank you for listening. Adele Ravella is a buyer persona evangelist who believes that by focusing on the creation of meaningful buyer personas, progressive B2B marketers can bring about a radical transformation in their organizations and, moreover, a radical transformation in the role that marketing can play in the enterprise. To find out more about these radical possibilities and how she became so interested in the power of buyer personas in the first place, I invited Adele to Marketing Smarts. The following conversation was the result. Now, before we get started, I want to remind you that if you like what you hear on Marketing Smarts, and even if you don't, you can always leave us a review in iTunes or a comment on our site. You're also welcome to reach out to me directly via email. My email address is mattg@marketingprofs.com, or you can find me on Twitter where I am Matt T. Grant. All right, without much further ado, let's get started. Adele, welcome to Marketing Smarts.
Thank you, Matthew. I'm very happy to be here this morning.
I'm very glad to have you on the show. And well, of course, as I said in my introduction, we will talk about buyer personas over the course of the conversation, but I wanted to go back and hear a little bit more about your background. And I know you have some stories about where the idea of buyer personas or the power of them was made very palpable to you. And so I'm hoping we can get to that. But first, I just wanted to ask you about this. You said on your blog that you were at one point VP of marketing for three companies that sold seriously obscure technology and services. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that. And you don't have to go into all three of the seriously obscure technologies, but now I'm really curious, like, what were they? What were you doing?
Thanks, Matthew. It's true. I mean, the first company where I was VP of marketing, this was so obscure that I would go to conferences and I would tell people what I did, and people would look at me with this very puzzled expression and say, "Really? Is that a real business?" Which can be quite depressing, you know, because you're kind of like, you're in marketing and your job is to go out there and make what you're doing really relevant to people. And people are thinking that you're just crazy. And so we were doing this thing called software escrow, which is still really obscure, but it became a standard business practice. And what made that happen during the 7 years where I was VP, because we eventually sold the company and it was a huge success, is that I had just taken this idea that I learned early in my career when I was in PR for a company called Regis McKenna that launched Apple and Intel in the 80s. And I learned that if I went out and just listened to how people talk about the problem we were trying to solve for them, that I could kind of take this knowledge we had, this vision we had as a company, or that rather the, you know, executives in the company had about where we were going to go, and I could kind of merge that with how the buyers thought about it. And I could find this sweet spot, this intersection between the two, so that no matter how crazy this was, because, you know, the second company was even more obscure. We were working in an area of network management that was around this part of the network operating system called directory services, and managing this loosely consistent database across huge enterprise networks. Again, really obscure stuff to somebody who's in marketing. But by going out and listening to the people who were using this technology, I found the access points that I needed as a marketer to be able to write messaging and develop content and to build a strategy for that company that would make these technologies, these ideas, commonplace.
Right. So if we could go back to the software escrow piece of it, because first of all, if even in a couple sentences you could explain to our listeners what software escrow is. And it was funny because even as you say it, like, I've done work with tech companies and stuff like that, and I never even heard of it. And yet, as you said, you guys did make a business out of it. But one of the things you've also written about is your sort of voyage of discovery to find out a kind of what was the problem in marketing a product that, yeah, most people didn't even know what it was about. Because it sounded like kind of getting out there and talking to people made you realize that the company had actually been talking to the wrong people about this.
Oh, yes, so true. So first of all, what is software escrow? So the simple answer is that there's a part of the software that's known as source code, which is the part that the programmers write. And then machines compile that and turn it into machine code and turn it into object code, which is what we get on our computers. That source code is secret. It's the part, the intellectual property of the company who wrote that code. And Microsoft and Oracle and all of those companies, none of them would want their customers or anyone to have access to the source code. What this means is that we're completely dependent upon those vendors to support us if we license their software. And so, especially back in the 90s when we were doing this, a lot of technology companies would go out of business or fail to support the software. What we did is we held that source code in escrow as a neutral third party so that in the event that certain contractual conditions occurred, the company went out of business or just stopped supporting the software because they didn't feel like it anymore, we would give the customers, the licensees, access to that code, and then they could support it themselves. And you know, frankly, this was a really good business idea, but it had to reach people, and it had to reach the right people. And we didn't know if we should be trying to sell this to the vendors who were building the software or the people who were licensing software, which is, by the way, everybody in the world. And how do you build buyer personas or understand a buyer if anybody in the world could be your customer? You can't. And then, of course, there were also this other party that was like attorneys that would get involved in these licensing transactions. And we thought maybe the attorneys were the people we should be building up this fledgling idea. You know, how do we go to market with this really obscure thing? Nobody's heard of it. Nobody thinks it's important. Nobody even knows that it exists. And so this was the problem I was confronted with.
And it sounded like the interesting thing was that you did some field research and going to conferences and had to discover, even to your horror, that people were talking about why your whole idea didn't work, and which I thought was kind of shocking. But the interesting thing to me was you ended up creating presentations around why it did work. And that is in part what led you to actually start interacting with the true buyers and the people who you really needed to be talking to about this product.
Yeah, and you know, it's tempting here to go off on a little bit of a tangent, but really I really owe all the credit for this idea to Regis McKenna, who practically nobody's ever heard of anymore. But here was a really brilliant marketing guy who literally launched Intel and Apple. And his degree was not in marketing. It was in this thing called phenomenology. And I can barely spell phenomenology, much less describe it to you. But what he understood is that marketing at its core was about finding the pressure points. And people that later went on to write about these things, like Malcolm Gladwell writing The Tipping Point, took a little bit of a different angle on it. But what I had to do for this escrow business, and I can't even tell you it was a conscious thought at the time because the idea of buyer personas didn't really exist then. But what I knew is I had to find some point in the industry where this problem was relevant. And so I simply started reading everything I could about anything that was published around software licensing. And one day I was sitting at my desk and I got a brochure for this company out of Winter Park, Florida, that had a conference, a workshop really, for people who negotiated software licensing agreements. And buried in 8-point font in the middle of this brochure, in the agenda for this 2.5-day workshop, was this one line that said why software escrow doesn't work. And so I immediately picked up the phone and called this company and said, you know, you're not helping your seminar attendees by telling them that it doesn't work. You would help them more if you told them how to make it work, how they should do it properly so that it would work. And so, long story, only sort of too long, I ended up leading an hour session at that seminar for the next years. I can't even remember how many years, 3 or 4 years. About how to do escrow that does work. And this became the tipping point, if you will, sorry, Malcolm Gladwell, for that industry. Because really this buyer persona who was attending this conference, this administrative level person who was really just a contracts and manager in a company, would go back from that seminar and she would say to her boss, gosh, boss, next time we do a software license agreement, we've got to add escrow to it. And that became that's what launched our industry. I mean, literally 25 people at a time in these sessions, and it just started. This was before social media, this was before browsers or the internet, really, in 1990, in the early 90s. And yet that became the point at which the market flipped and turned, and escrow did become, and still is to this day, a standard part of software licensing negotiations.
Wow, nice. First of all, that's a good story. Second of all, I don't mind digressions. Third of all, I studied philosophy both as the graduate and undergraduate level, so I actually, if we can talk about phenomenology later. but 'cause I don't want to bore our listeners with that, even though it is fascinating. But what was interesting to me in that story is this idea we have about content marketing, which it's, I mean, part of your, and I want to get in the second into buyer personas specifically, but the idea that we need to develop these personas so we know who we're writing our content for. But I like about that story because it shows there's, I mean, content and what you can do with content and education kind of goes beyond that. And in part, what you're saying is you can use content even to start to create these a market in a sense, and even you draw the buyers out, even if you don't know exactly who they are, which was kind of what your story was. But by actually talking about this, you start drawing the buyers out and finding out more about your buyers just by producing content in a sense before you even know who they are. Is that sound like a crazy idea?
Well, no, it's not crazy, Matt. I mean, the story that I told you, not only is the technology obscure, but fortunately, the circumstances that I was in at the time is also relatively obscure. By the time most marketers get to their job, they've found some part of the market who wants to buy the thing that they're selling. And, so the right place to begin is with those buyers and with anybody else that you can find that might be a buyer. And the key to the success of every story, and I have so many of them really, is that we go out and we listen to these people. I have a shorter story about this client a few years ago who was selling technology for demurrage claims. Now, you knew what phenomenology is, but I bet you don't know what demurrage is. Do you, Matt?
I don't.
Okay.
I must
Well, neither did
demur.
I. And yet it was a client who had this technology to handle this problem. And so, lo and behold, I find out there's a conference in London that's for people who manage these demurrage claims. And demurrage is all about the shipping industry, like oil, people shipping oil and gas. And these big tankers show up at a port, and if they can't offload their product within the contracted period of time, there's a claim for demurrage. It's demurrage is from Latin for delay, and demoye or something like that. And so I go to this 2-day conference, and I really am there. This company hasn't launched this product yet, and there's a bunch of people there that this is their whole life. This is what they care about. And what I do is I go around and I just talk to people. So I'm listening at the sessions, of course, but at every break, I am going around and asking people about the challenges that they faced handling demurrage claims. And within 2 days, I'd talked to 22 people. And I was able to come back from that conference and tell my client that this product didn't have a prayer, that they should kill this product, that there wasn't any chance that they were going to get people to use it, that these people were so opposed to using technology to solve this problem. They had sent me to find out about the price point. And again, it was a three-party transaction: the ship owner, the purchaser of the ship, the company, or the purchaser of the oil, plus the company that was shipping the oil, and who should pay the price. And it was a little bit like the escrow transaction in that they didn't know who was going to want to pay for this. And I was able to go back and say, kill this product. And they did. And the CEO told me, he said at the end, he said, Adele, I think we should have paid you double for this because you saved us from launching a product that wasn't going to work. And so it's really about us as marketers finding opportunities. And fortunately, we don't usually have to work quite as hard. We don't have to fly to London and go to a demurrage conference. But the other part of the story I want people to get is that you can be successful as a marketer with stuff that you can barely spell. because all you have to do is go out and listen to how buyers think about that story, think about that technology, and you're going to be the smartest person in the company and have data that everybody truly values, that you are the expert on how buyers think. And this is our objective.
Right. And that actually brings up a point that I've been thinking about a lot over the last few months, and especially when, there was some stuff that had come out which said that most people, like they'd done some survey, was an Ad Age, and talked about how most people don't have any respect for marketers. And in fact, it's seen as a role in society that is less valuable than being an actor or a politician, which I think kind of hurts people's feelings, but that's what the data showed. And I read about that right after I'd read some like CMO surveys CEO surveys, and they were talking about how they just didn't respect marketers and marketers didn't understand numbers and all this other stuff. Like there's this very kind of anti-marketing kind of vibe in there. And really, that raises this question, well, what's the future of marketing? And my thought was that the marketers really should be the ones in the company who own the customer and customer insight and customer. They really understand the customer not at the anecdotal one-to-one level that sales might, but at a broader, more informed kind of big picture level that is actually a practical big picture. And it seems like making that vision for marketing come true hinges on marketing's ability to create real buyer personas. But a key piece of that is something you just mentioned, which is getting out of the office and actually talking to real customers, and not just customers, but buyers. So you're really understanding the market and not just the people your company's already interacting with. I guess my question is, what are the challenges, or what makes that so hard? Since it seems, I'm not even a marketer by training, but I see the value of doing that. And yet it seems like it's something most marketers just assume they're not going to talk directly to customers. Why is there this breakdown when it's obviously so valuable to have these interactions?
Well, Matt, it's a great question. And I can only speak for the B2B kind of complex buying situation, which is where I've spent my career. But I can tell you that in those companies where deals are huge, every deal is huge, and you know it takes years for a customer, or at least months for a customer, to make a decision about which vendor they're going to choose, the salesperson does own the customer. And it's always been the company's view that marketing was sort of a support organization to the salespeople. And then if you take it even a step further, the marketers were really kind of like in this factory, I like to think of it like the back room, pumping out stuff that was supposed to support the salespeople and getting more deals. Now, you know, I think that the modern era, and it isn't really about buyer personas per se, because that's really just an artifact of, or in a way to express our buyer expertise in a document that can be shared and understood by others in the company. But the real issue, and I wrote about this for CMO.com last year, I wrote an article for CMO.com, which turned out to be in their top 10 articles for the year for all of 2012, so I know it hit a sore spot. And my point is that marketers need a distinctive core competence. And so I don't know about comparing marketers to politicians or actors, but I can compare marketing to other roles within the company. And I would suggest that marketing is the only group in the company that does not possess what the company perceives to be unique skill set that makes them uniquely qualified to do the work they're performing. And so nobody would question that finance is best qualified to keep the books, or that the developers know how to write this code or build complex products. But people all throughout the company second-guess marketing and wonder what marketing's really doing, because it seems like writing some copy, writing sentences, you know, building all of this material is something that anyone could do. And so this is really distressing. And my perspective is that there is a missing there's a huge opportunity here, because A, there's a missing competency in the organization, and B, marketing is uniquely qualified to fulfill it. And here's what it is. If you think about salespeople, at the core of it, their job is persuading one buyer at a time. If you think about marketers, our job is to persuade a market full of buyers at a time. But fundamentally, we're both trying to persuade people to choose us rather than a competitor or the status quo. And so if that's true, ask sales if you would ever expect, ask any sales manager if they would expect their salespeople to go persuade one buyer at a time without first having a meeting with that buyer and understanding their needs. And yet marketers are, you know, put in the back room of the factory, sort of in a production mode, trying to persuade markets full of buyers, which I say is harder. It's much harder to persuade a bunch of people, ask politicians. They could all persuade one voter at a time because they can adjust their story for that voter. But if a politician has to go persuade all of the voters to vote for them, that's harder and it takes more skill. And so the same thing's true for marketers. And we're handicapped by not having the skills or the culture to support us actually listening to the people we're trying to persuade. And so if marketing is going to persuade a market full of buyers, then what we need is an opportunity, first of all, to listen to buyers. And the good news is, unlike my stories, you don't have to go out and go to conferences. You don't need a travel budget. You can do this on the telephone. And you can reach people. And with just a few hours of training, marketers can gain the skills. And this is a new skill. They've never learned how to do this, to get buyers to share what's needed to be shared so that they really have deep insight. And this is missing. A lot of people are just not doing this, haven't learned how to do this yet. And it's really hampering. It's very scary because people are saying to me, well, buyer personas don't work. It's really reminiscent of software escrow doesn't work. Well, buyer personas don't work if you make stuff up. They work if you listen to buyers first.
Right. And you make that very clear. I mean, throughout what you've written, but especially in your buyer persona manifesto, you can't make things up. You actually have to talk to people. But it sounded like when you were talking just now that the marketers have to learn a skill they don't have. That skill seems to be how to, at least in part, as you write, how to conduct a uniquely structured but unscripted conversation. And that was one of the interesting things. It almost sounded like you were talking about this Zen perspective or a kind of improv approach where really to get buyer personas and get the information you need to create very useful, practical, effective buyer personas, that you need to be able to have a conversation that isn't, it's weird, like you have to have a conversation that's going to get you the information you want, but in a way that's not rote or scripted, that is truly conversational. And I don't know what it is that you do in your workshops and things like that to help people learn how to do that, but maybe you could sketch that out a little bit, because that seems like it's something like that seems like an art that it might take someone a while to truly master.
Yeah, well, it's like anything for marketing. There's a little bit of skill involved in doing it, and the more you practice it, the better you get at it. But the fact is, we're training people every week to do this work with just a few hours of training. The main reason I talk about it the way I do, with it being structured but unscripted, is that whenever you ask people to go have a conversation with someone, the first thing they want is the script. You know, send me the questions I should ask. And we've learned long ago that when you ask someone a direct question, it's very, very rare. I'd say almost never do you get an answer that you haven't already heard before. And that the skill of really getting expertise about the buyer and really having insight, you know, which I use that word very deliberately. Insight is something that really changes things for you. We're looking for 5 insights about our buyers. And if we just ask a question and write down the answer, we're not going to get to insight. What's required is that we probe on the buyer's answer and get to what they didn't say in that short answer. And sometimes it takes repeated probing to really get to the point where you get the information you need. And we've developed a methodology to teach marketers how to do that.
So on that point, that this is a real technique and method that people can learn, and that there's a right way and a wrong way to do it, I thought it was interesting that you have one of the gate you have on this content. Like if you go to your website and to download the templates for creating buyer personas, you ask people to make a promise that they won't misuse them. And I don't think I'd ever seen it. You know, you're like, we're not going to ask for any information from you or anything like that. We just want you to promise you're not going to use these in the wrong way. I was just wondering why you did it that way and what kind of response you've got from that.
You're the first person who's ever really commented on it, Matthew. I think everybody just says, oh, okay. It just says, I accept. So they push, I accept. And nobody read what I said. But the reason I did that is because it is, you know, people are really expecting. I know my buyer persona. I know how marketers think. And I know that if you give them a template, what they'll do is fill it in. I have a whole rant I've done on templates before. It's actually why I kind of hate templates is because, you know, if you tell me I need to have a 50-word statement about my product, I'll come up with 50 words, flexible, scalable, compatible, enterprise-wide. And I was worried that that's what people would do with my buyer persona templates. I don't want to harass people. I don't want to follow up with them. I want people to get them freely. That's why there's no data collected. But I want people to know that if you just ask people these questions or if you just sit in a room and make things up and, you know, or just collect internal opinions to fill in this template, that you don't yet have a buyer persona. All you have is a reformatting of your lack of insight knowledge about your buyer. You know, you just have reformatted useless data.
Right. And that's what I thought it was interesting, that one of the things people had to agree to was, I'm not just going to ask these questions directly. And this goes back to this idea that it has to be unscripted. And because, again, if you're following a script, you're not usually listening. You're just trying to say, oh, when do I get to say my next line? And so that's where it reminded me of sort of improv theater and the kind of training people have to go through to get good at that. But I think that's the last question I wanted to ask. It goes back to your buyer persona manifesto, because you say in there that this ebook is not a how-to guide for dabblers. It is a manifesto for radical transformation aimed at progressive B2B marketers who won't sit still for the status quo. So I'm just wondering why, in what way is this focus on buyer personas and creating them in a meaningful way? Why is that a radical transformation of marketing, and particularly in the B2B context?
Well, it's radical because companies have become so accustomed to the kind of marketing that you described and that was mentioned by Ad Age and others. And, you know, culturally, to have marketers who are sitting at a table where strategic decisions are being made and bringing the buyer's perspective to that decision is radical. It's a part of my CMO article, but, you know, I notice, and having been in an executive role for over 11 years and then been a consultant for many years, that when most strategic decisions are made in companies, the people sitting around the table are focused on the impact that that's going to have on their department, on their area of responsibility. Can we or can we not support this strategic decision? And, you know, the buyer is the one who's really going to decide, who's going to vote with their pocketbook about whether that strategy is going to help the company to be more successful. But they're not represented at that meeting. The salespeople certainly can't represent a market full of buyers. They represent one account at a time. And if they're at that meeting, they're talking about the one big deal they're working on at the moment. And so this idea of having someone in the company whose responsibility is to, on a sustainable basis, and this is why we do this, this is why I chose to do a company like I do for Buyer Persona at Buyer Persona Institute to train marketers how to do this work rather than doing this work for them, is that we want to see marketing become a constant source of current insight about what the buyers are saying, so that whatever strategic decision is being made, marketing is there to help with that decision. And, you know, back in my day, marketing was the t-shirt department. And so that's pretty radical, don't you think, Matthew, to go from being like the people that are worried about the color of the fonts and whether we're using Arial or Times New Roman, and now we're there sitting at strategic meetings saying, you know, We've been talking to the buyers. This is what really matters to them. And so here's the buyer's perspective on that strategy. That's pretty radical, I say.
And I agree, and especially in the B2B context, where, as you pointed out, in a lot of ways, B2B has, I mean, marketing has traditionally been relegated to this sales support function, and in part what the sales team has always had, I mean, aside from the direct revenue that they can claim, has been, look, I'm the one talking to customers, so I know what they really want. And marketing, what do you know? And unless marketers are actually out there talking to people, and even talking to people the salespeople are not talking to, then in a sense, sales will always win those kinds of arguments. So, Adele, that's all the time we have for our interview today. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us. If people wanted to find out more about your work and buyer personas and your workshops and things like that, where would you send them?
To buyerpersona.com. And I'm
Perfect.
also on Facebook at facebook.com/buyerpersona. And I'm on Twitter at buyerpersona. So
So you've got
you
it
don't
all
have
wrapped
to
up.
lose me.
Nice. All right, Adele. Well, thanks again for joining us today. And also thank you, listener, for listening here to the very end. This has been the Marketing Smarts Podcast, brought to you by Marketing Profs. I've been your host, Matthew Grant. Talk to you next week.